Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Farah Hassan, a research fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, who discusses the resilience of the Iranian opposition movement as they confront increasing repression at the hands of police and militia groups. Bruce Gagnon of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, who explains why he believes pilotless drones used by the U.S. military are creating more enemies than they eliminate. And Peter Montgomery with the group People for the American Way, who talks about his new report titled Rise of the New McCarthyism, how right-wing extremists try to paralyze government through ideological smears and baseless attacks. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories. Federal District Judge Ricardo Urbina has dismissed criminal charges against five Blackwater security guards indicted for killing 17 civilians in Iraq in 2007. In a 90-page ruling issued on December 31st, Judge Urbina blasted federal prosecutors for using statements by the security guards given to the State Department after the shooting. According to Urbina, these statements were given with the understanding that they would not be used to press criminal charges against the security officers. Blackwater had a contract to provide security for State Department workers in Iraq. In December 2008, five Blackwater guards were indicted on manslaughter and weapons charges, including killing unarmed civilians, and a sixth guard pled guilty. An immunity agreement signed by the Coalition Provisional Authority that governed Iraq after the 2003 U.S. invasion prevented the Iraqi government from prosecuting the men. Fareed Waleed Hassan, who was injured in the Blackwater shooting, told the Washington Post, "The world quaked because of this crime. How have we lost our rights so quickly?" The Justice Department can appeal the ruling, but legal experts say the dismissal will likely hold up. However, the Iraqi government announced that it will file a civil suit against Blackwater and ask the Justice Department to appeal the dismissal of criminal charges. Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin has thrown a roadblock into U.S.-Russian arms control negotiations by blasting the United States in a late December press conference for continuing to develop missile defense systems. Putin, often seen as the hidden power in the Kremlin, boasted that Russia will work to build new offensive weapons systems. According to the Christian Science Monitor, many Kremlin watchers who expect Putin to run for another term as Russian president in 2012 say the prime minister is playing hardball to win concessions against the Obama administration. The existing START arms reduction treaty expired on December 5th, and Russian and U.S. negotiators were apparently close to a new arms control treaty. Arms negotiations picked up speed in September after President Obama scrapped plans for deploying a missile defense system in Poland and the Czech Republic. The pending arms treaty is expected to cut strategic nuclear weapons to 1,600 warheads on each side. Moreover, the treaty draft currently allows each country to build new offensive weapons within overall treaty limits. Russian weapons under development include the Balava, a new submarine anti-ballistic missile that failed in recent tests. The Kremlin is also seeking to replace old Soviet-era SS-18 intercontinental missiles with a new offensive weapon system, the RS-24. In lively, low-income immigrant neighborhoods, buying food such as kebabs and tamales from street vendors has become a regular habit. For generations, urban street vendors have provided an entryway for new immigrants to establish small businesses and move up the career ladder. In Chicago, many of the immigrant street traders operate illegally because the city prohibits the selling of sliced or cooked food. Part-time street vendor Jose Tafoya has been issued three $250 fines for selling tamales and corn from a cart in Little Village, a mostly Mexican-American neighborhood in Chicago. Tafoya joined a Latino Street Vendors Association, which is lobbying City Hall for a new ordinance to allow more vendors to sell legally. According to the news magazine In These Times, opposition to street vendors comes mostly from store owners afraid of competition and real estate developers looking to gentrify urban neighborhoods. In the mid-1990s, Mayor Richard M. Daley shut down the successful Maxwell Street Market, used by immigrant vendors since 1912, to make way for the expansion of the University of Illinois, Chicago. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
In the face of violent repression, opponents of the Iranian government have refused to back down in their protests against what they claim was a stolen presidential election on June 12th. In street demonstrations organized to coincide with the holy day of Ashura on December 27th, hundreds of thousands of Iranians marched and held anti-government rallies, many of which erupted into clashes with police and members of the pro-government Basij militia. At least 8 protesters were reported killed, including the nephew of leading opposition presidential candidate Meir Hossein Mousavi. On January 4th, 88 professors at Tehran University recently risked arrest to sign a letter demanding that the country's supreme religious leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, stop police from using violent attacks against protesters, saying it was a sign of the government's weakness. The regime repeatedly claims that opposition groups are being manipulated by foreign governments intent on overthrowing Iran's Islamic Republic. Despite the violence and massive arrests, a crackdown on opposition media outlets, and attempts to censor the internet and phone text messaging, the Iranian protest movement appears to be holding its own, if not gaining strength. But in its confrontation with Iran over its nuclear program, the Obama administration is now threatening to impose sanctions that could blow back against the opposition. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Farah Hassan, a research fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, who discusses the resilience of the Iranian opposition activists and the danger posed to the movement by international sanctions.
Well, I think resilience and strength, those are our two key words here, because after all, these are protesters who have continued to ask the question, where is my vote, since the disputed and what many would call stolen election of June 12th. And I think it's also important to highlight here the fact that this swelling opposition movement did not just start with the disputed election. If you look at the emerging Iranian blogosphere alone, you'll see that many Iranians took to blogs, young, old, irrespective of class lines, to air their grievances about the trajectory of their own country, to question the Islamic Republic, the rule of the Ayatollahs. And so this is something that's been happening even well before June 12th, even well before the ascendancy of Ahmadinejad. And so I would highlight that. And then in terms of who we're talking about, who's protesting here, and where do they come from, I don't think it's clear quite yet that we can say that they're all uniform, that they fit a certain class or a certain age, or that they come from this university or that province. I think those who have come out since June 12th, though, have demonstrated a commitment to challenge and still question where their vote went. And I would paraphrase one Iranian, the professor at Columbia University, Hamid Dabashi, who has said the color green will remain the uncertain solace of this moment, that no one will know exactly what that color means, which has been identified with the opposition movement, and that perhaps that's a good thing, to be contrarian and to challenge people in power, whatever the color green means. And so it remains to be seen how long those opposition will continue to flood the streets. And I think the other question, too, is how much longer the regime itself can put up with this situation. I mean, it seems it's tried to contain the protesters, and we've seen images of those on the streets being beaten. But then we've also seen counter demonstrations, and some will say that those have been, of course, sponsored by the regime, which is to conclude by saying, aside from seeing the resiliency and strength of this opposition movement, we also see a still a deeply fractured country.
As you said before, we're not talking about a clearly unified group of opposition activists. They have different goals and objectives. But if you were to break it down for us, how would you characterize the largest number of these opposition activists? Do you think they want reform of the system, or they'd like to see the Islamic Republic system abolished out of opposition to a theocratic government?
I think the key word would be reform. And I mean, I think for sure we can say that there's been much discontent aired at the rule of the Ayatollah Khomeini, who really holds the power here. I mean, even within other Ayatollahs in the system who have questioned the rule of the Grand Ayatollah, for example, from Rafsanjani questioning the decision-making of Khomeini, I mean, which reveals divisions within the system itself, which is very significant, notwithstanding the country's larger divisions in terms of where Iranians see their country going and their trajectory. But I think reform, that's something that isn't a new issue here at all. And I think if you put a broader perspective on this issue, reform, democratic reform, this is something we're not hearing as much about it right now, but it's an issue in Syria. It's an issue in Lebanon. It's an issue in Jordan. It's an issue even within Saudi Arabia and in Egypt, our allies. So this is a larger issue for the region itself.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is now discussing details on how to pressure and impose sanctions on Iran with U.S. allies. What do you think the effect of sanctions, if they are imposed as a result of this nuclear confrontation, what effect will those sanctions have on the opposition groups opposing Ahmadinejad's government?
The thing to remember about sanctions is that they only really work when they are supported by the majority of a people. And it is not clear, we have not heard a majority of Iranians calling for sanctions. And so therefore that puts a big question on their efficacy. And I think if nothing else, sanctions could not only strengthen Iran's hardliners and confirm their suspicions that the U.S. under President Obama is not serious about relations based on mutual interest and mutual respect, allowing officials to really justify economic woes, mismanagement, and other internal challenges on the sanctions. It could also deal further blows to reformists and activists who are still recovering from the wounds of the disputed election and are still fighting for that question of where their vote went.
That was Farah Hassan, a research fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Contact the Institute by calling area code 202-234-9382 or visit their website at ips-dc.org. As pilotless military planes, known as drones, play an ever larger role in the war in Afghanistan and Pakistan, many Americans think they are a better option than putting pilots at risk to conduct bombing runs over enemy territory. But the drones, which are launched to kill insurgents, often kill or injure civilians instead, or in addition to the intended targets, angering the very people whose hearts and minds the United States is hoping to win in its war against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. One of the organizations that has been focusing on this issue is the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. The group is organizing a protest against drone attacks at CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, on January 16th. The network's founder and coordinator, Bruce Gagnon, recently gave the keynote address at the annual meeting of the group promoting enduring peace in New Haven, Connecticut. What follows is an excerpt of that talk in which Gagnon explains how drones are programmed from U.S. bases using space technology and why he believes that use of drones may prolong, not shorten, the wars being fought in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
When you think back to the U.S. shock and awe invasion of Iraq in 2003, in the initial attack, 70% of the weapons that were used by the United States were directed to their targets by space satellites. And so the U.S. clearly understands, the Pentagon clearly understands, that whoever controls space is going to control everything on the planet Earth militarily. They say that we will be the master of space and ultimately then the master of the planet below, to benefit corporate globalization. And so the Space Command really has become, if you will, the military arm of corporate globalization. With our army, we'll control the Earth on the ground. With our Navy, we'll control the oceans. With our Air Force, we'll control the air above the Earth. And then with the Space Command, tying it all together, we'll control space. A seamless web, if you will, of insanity and madness and massive spending. They brag, they say that Star Wars space technology will be the largest industrial project in the history of the planet Earth, costing so much that they're going to have to defund essentially social progress to pay for it. These same space technology systems today are flying pilotless planes, unmanned aerial vehicles, or drones as they're often called, over Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. These drones, called the Reaper or the Predator, are flown by pilots sitting in front of computer terminals with joysticks at bases inside the United States, places like Creech Air Force Base, outside of Las Vegas, Nevada. The drones are outfitted with cameras where they fly over a particular area and in real time, split second time, send back images via satellite back to these guys sitting at these computer terminals here in the United States. Some of the drones are outfitted with Hellfire missiles that they can then fire. A 1 second delay and then it's fired over Afghanistan or Pakistan. In 2007, there are 112 of these Hellfire missile attacks. In 2008, 132 of these attacks. And in 2009, well over 100 attacks in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And we know from recent days, Obama's recent surge speech, that he's saying that we're going to increase the use of these drone attacks in Pakistan as the U.S. now widens the war in Pakistan. Drones are being used, they say, at the Pentagon because they make killing easier, cheaper, and with less troops needed. The military calls it increasing the kill chain. And since August of 2008, just in Pakistan alone, well over 700 civilians have been killed. You can see them now sitting at their screen at Creech Air Force Base in Nevada. Is it Al-Qaeda? Is it the Taliban? Is it a wedding or even a funeral as people increasingly get killed? You heard about the people that were at a wedding and they got killed and then there was a funeral to bury them and the funeral got attacked. But when you listen to the politicians and you listen to the military talk about these drones, they talk about how antiseptic they are and how clean it all is. And that's totally a lie. We're creating more enemies in Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan by using these. And I can't help but wonder if that's not part of the strategy for endless war. Because the more enemies you make, you know, then, well, you got to stay. And in Afghanistan, we know we're building these huge bases now, just like we did in Iraq. Pentagon called them enduring bases that are ultimately never going to close. I saw just a quote the other day from Gates saying that the Air Force is staying in Iraq. They're not coming home.
That was Bruce Gagnon of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space and author of the book Come Together Right Now, Organizing Stories from a Fading Empire. Contact the network at area code 207-443-9502. Or visit their website at spaceforpeace.org. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. The term McCarthyism has its origins in a dark era in U.S. history, when, during the 1950s, Wisconsin Republican Senator Joseph R. McCarthy warned the nation about the enemies from within, and made broad accusations that communists had infiltrated the highest levels of the American government. After the end of World War II and the rise of the Soviet Union, there was much fear about the threat posed by communism, and conservative politicians like McCarthy exploited that fear with campaigns based on red-baiting and allegations of disloyalty. McCarthy was eventually exposed as a fraud and a demagogue, but not before he succeeded in destroying many lives of innocent victims caught in his web of fear and lies. Today, there's an echo of McCarthyism in the conservative Tea Party protesters and other right-wing activists whose signs and shouts at town hall meetings and rallies label President Obama and his supporters as communists, traitors, and describe health care reform legislation as a plot to launch another Holocaust. Right-wing media commentators like Glenn Beck, Bill O'Reilly, and Rush Limbaugh serve as an echo chamber repeating these attacks and discredited conspiracy theories. In a new report titled Rise of the New McCarthyism, How Right-Wing Extremists Try to Paralyze Government Through Ideological Smears and Baseless Attacks, the author, Peter Montgomery, examines the parallels between the McCarthy era and today's conservative political tactics. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Montgomery, a senior fellow with the group People for the American Way, who talks about the danger he sees in organized right-wing attacks against intellectual elites, liberal media, and gays, while appealing to nativist and racist sentiment.
I do think the change during the presidential campaign of Obama, and certainly since his election, it has just been a sea change in the kind of attacks and fear-mongering that have been unleashed by right-wing media personalities and religious right organizations who basically, you know, want to do anything in their power to stymie President Obama and to, you know, bring down his administration. Even just a few years ago, anyone sort of hurling accusations of someone being like Hitler or Stalin was considered sort of so off, far off the fringe that no one would take them seriously. Now we hear that all the time. I mean, people on the right accuse the Obama administration and congressional leaders of being socialists and communists and promoting fascist tyranny in the United States so often that it's kind of lost its shock value. But it's to me one sign of how far this has gone in such a short time.
And how much of this has to do with race, do you think? A lot of people say the United States has transcended the issue of race with the election of Barack Obama, ignoring the fact that the majority of white voters in this country voted against Barack Obama in the November 2008 election. But how much do you think the stoking of fear and these kind of very harsh criticisms and labeling of political opponents as communists or fascists, how much do you think that has to do with Barack Obama being an African-American president, the first?
I think there's no question that race is a piece of this, and it's certainly Obama's election was an important milestone for the country, but even during the campaign, and certainly since then, you could see that racism is alive and well. And since then, the use of racial resentment by people on the right, from Glenn Beck to Pat Buchanan, encouraging the Republican Party to tell white voters and saying to white voters, Obama is a racist. You know, Sonia Sotomayor is a racist. These new people who've taken over are not like us. They're trying to sell out the country and take the country away from you. So I think there is a tremendous amount of the use of racism and fueling racial resentment in the attacks on Obama and on his allies in Congress. And I think it's a piece of this larger picture of intimidation and fear-mongering in an effort to really frighten a large swath of voters out there into thinking that the country is on a quick slide to tyranny.
Peter Montgomery, there are some people who minimize the threat of people with signs that compare President Obama with Stalin and labeling him a communist or a socialist, saying this is really just appealing to the really hardcore rock-bottom base of the Republican Party and that they do more damage to themselves by marginalizing themselves at the fringes of American politics. But you have a concern that this is spreading far beyond this extreme right-wing base who loves to hear this kind of rhetoric.
And I think that the question is also, even if that base is not a majority of America, which I think, fortunately, it is not a majority of America, but say it's 20% or 25%. For some significant group of the public, and a very significant, a more significant group from the Republican Party, for them to be told over and over again by their political leaders, by media figures who they trust, by religious figures, whoever it is, to be told over and over again that the president is not really our president, he's out to undermine America, that he and his allies are working behind the scenes to destroy your faith and your family, to make it illegal for your church to be your church. I mean, that is a really kind of insidious thing. If you convince millions of Americans that all that is true, it really makes it impossible to have any kind of, you know, common ground approach to politics or compromise or anything. And I think it will ultimately encourage more people toward violence. One of the other figures who's out there, former Senator Rick Santorum, who, you know, seems to be considering a possible run for the presidency along with Mike Huckabee and Sarah Palin and others out there. You know, Santorum was recently out there talking about sort of tying together this notion of socialism with that criticism that the religious right has often used against the gay rights movement, saying if you support equality for gay people, that means that you're trying to destroy religious liberty. And so he said there's an assault on marriage because the left knows they can't have government come in and take control of everything unless they destroy the family. Unless you destroy the family and destroy the church, they cannot ultimately be successful in getting socialism to be accepted in this country, and that's what their objective is. So here's someone who is a former U.S. senator, possibly a presidential candidate, who's out there telling people that it's not just that we disagree with someone on health care reform. It's that the Democratic approach to health care reform is an actual effort to destroy the family and destroy the church in order to impose a socialist regime on this country. That's not just some fringe person sitting there, you know, grumbling to himself in a backwoods cabin.
That was Peter Montgomery, a senior fellow at the group People for the American Way. Read a copy of his report, Rise of the New McCarthyism, online at pfaw.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced in association with WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.